You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
Christian Ed Cameron is the author of more novels than I have time to even give the title from. He's the author of more series than many authors have novels to their name. These series include Masters in Magic, Chivalry Series, The Traitor Sun Cycle, The Adventures of Tom Swan, Age of Bronze Tyrant, The Long War Commanders, and Alan Craig. They are in both history and fantasy. His new science fiction series is Arcana Imperii. Thank you for joining me, Christian.
It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you very much for having me.
You are writing this series as Miles Cameron. It's your first venture into science fiction. You have a long history of storytelling. What made you decide to enter the world of science fiction? It's topsy-turvy. It's very rot and change right now as a result of the, what is happening in America. The Hugos are constantly afoot with problems. Talk about your decision to write science fiction, having written many books of history and fantasy.
Sure. I'm a storyteller, so I'm going to tell you a story. I was at a British fantasy con, and I think this is back in 2016 or 2017. And by pure luck, I got to seize the seat next to one of my favorite writers, a British writer named Alistair Reynolds, who's a real life scientist, as well as being my favorite current science fiction writer. And he was sitting there alone, I guess, because he was famous and people were afraid to sit next to him. And I popped in next to him and went and did the usual fanboy things. I didn't say I'm a writer. I said like, oh, I love your books and blah, blah, blah. And he looked suitably bored. And then he said, I'm cutting to the point, you're Miles Cameron. And I said, yes, I am. He said, you were on aircraft carriers in the United States Navy. And I said, yes, I was. He's like, tell me about that. I'm fascinated with aircraft carriers. I built one as a model. So we had a 20-minute conversation about aircraft carriers and using aircraft carriers as a model for long-range space travel, like for going places for a long time, because one of the most interesting aspects of a nuclear aircraft carrier is that there's 6,000 people on board and you stay at sea for 6 months and you really don't need to touch land. I mean, we do, but you don't have to. So we sort of talked about that. And I said sort of mutteringly, well, sometimes I've thought about writing a science fiction story based on aircraft carriers. And my editor turned around and said, I'd buy that. Now, these are very important words when you're a professional author. So my dad was a writer and a very prolific writer.
Can I ask who your editor was?
Gillian Redfern of Gallants, the best editor. I can say this with a straight face. She is the best editor I've ever had. I love working with Gillian. And it's always important to me to please her. I won't lie. Anyway, my dad used to say, an idea is not the same as a book. And his variation on that was to say, the difference between an idea and a book is usually about 395 pages. And aircraft carriers in space sounds like military science fiction, kind of not the place I was going in my head. So that just sat there. Nothing happened for a while. And then while I was writing a historical novel, I learned a lot more about long-range trade in the Middle Ages. So this is the trade from Venice and Genoa around the Mediterranean and also up to England and Flanders via Spain, where these enormous galleys, and they were galleys, sort of traded with everyone. So they'd go to the Islamic ports and then they'd work their way across the top of Africa and then they'd go up the coast of Spain and Portugal and then they'd go to England. And this is why the English still have ginger festivals, because Venetian ships would show up and sell them ginger. Anyway, and I thought, wow, this is a fascinating model for something in science fiction, like this long range trade that goes on with these long voyages. And so then I was sort of most of the way there. But the truth is that books are really about characters, not about world building. I love world building. I play role playing games. I play tabletop war games. I love all the minutia. But at some point, there need to be characters. And so the last part of this tale was, I think it was the last thing my partner and I did before we got locked down for COVID. We went to see a movie called Little Women. And I'm probably being too long-winded, but one of my favorite teachers ever used to say that art makes art, and that she made some of her best art in her head while listening to or watching other people's art. I have always found that true. The inspiration isn't always direct. It's not that I look at a painting and go like, wow, I'm going to use this painting in my book. It's more like somehow my mind free associates and I come up with ideas. Anyway, all my life I've heard that art makes art. So I was watching Florence Pugh be Amy in Little Women, and I loved the novel Little Women as a kid. And she, I'm going to paraphrase her line. I won't remember it exactly, but one of the male characters says, oh, you're such a great artist. And Amy says, you know what? I'm not a great artist. And you know what that means? That means that for the rest of my life, I get to have a rich man's babies. And I thought, what a remarkably feminist line for 1865. But then I was like, what if Amy could go into space? And anyway, believe it or not, that was sort of my thought. And then it all came together. And by the time I walked out of that movie theater, I knew most of the plot of Artifact Space, and I knew who the characters were going to be. And it came into my head like divine inspiration. It wasn't like I was plotting while watching the movie. It's that I can remember very clearly walking down the corridor out of the movie theater and going like, it's all there. I can see the whole book. And I wrote most of that book in 45 days.
Wow. Well, you know, one of the things that I really like about this book, it is the writing. I think the prose, my take is that having written as much as you have written, having published as much as you have published, you've really learned how to apply the writing tool to anything you write about. Because every time I picked up the book, I thought, wow, I'm looking forward to this.
Well, that is lovely. It's lovely to hear. And I will say, and this is like a hobby horse of mine, there is a tendency, which I bless you for not mentioning, to say he's written 50 books. He can't be a very good writer, because we have this myth that great writing is like The Great Gatsby, where your first novel is a great novel. And usually the first novel is the best novel. It's an interesting point of view, but I would challenge it based on any other profession in the world and say, how many people believe their first work is their best work? In any craft, in anyway, I think you get where I'm going. So yeah, I've had a lot of practice. And what might seem even worse is that I sandbox stuff all the time. So I have work you'll never see. Sometimes I just write a short story about a character who's not the main character so that I get to know them and their background. And I may never bring that up in the course of a novel, but I want to know who that person is and how they reacted in some situation. And I'll sort of whip off a short story, which I call sandboxing. I realize it's not the same for your Silicon Valley professionals, but I've written whole novels you'll never see because a subject interested me and I write it and put it away. I write fast. And that, you know, allows me the privilege of doing this. But yeah, I've been in this business a long time. And I have some idea how to use the tools. And I'll just mention one because I think you're too nice to mention it. There is a section of the novel I wrote to be boring. And it's completely deliberate. I want the reader to get because I try to write immersion. I try and make you be in the moment. And I want the reader to get the feeling of what it would be like to be on months and months and months of space travel. You know, not much is happening. You do your routine paperwork, you move along, and there's that whole sequence where it's just sort of, you know, she's a very junior officer. She's constantly training. She's watching sims. And I wanted to get across like, yep, it's not all excitement. This should be the dullest 30 pages of space opera you ever read. But anyone who's been in the real military or the real merchant service or the real or at sea knows that there are long periods of training and boredom.
You know, one of the things that I really loved about this novel was that I think it captures insight into your main character. Marika Mbaro, is that correct?
Yeah, it is correct. Yep.
I think that throughout the novel, she suffers from the psychological malady that is really common, rarely discussed, the imposter syndrome. So many people who are really professional, great at what they do, didn't train for that, and they just came to it some other way. Or even if they did train for it, they don't feel that they came to it officially, so to speak. Feel like, you know, they're doing something, they're doing a great job, but somebody's gonna catch them and out them as an imposter. And I think that fear hangers over this character for much of the book and makes her really relatable and also relevant into today's techno culture, where, you know, 99.9% of the people who watch TV or watch a movie have no idea how the equipment that makes that happen works.
You've hit that bang on. Again, I had this idea for a character. I'm not even positive where it came from. I will definitely say, for instance, one of the best martial arts teachers I know has massive imposter syndrome and in a way can't shut up about it, which makes him charming. But at times you just want to say, dude, you're like the best. Where is this coming from? But it also makes Marika Mbaro human. Now, in the first book in Artifact Space, it is possible to end that book saying, wow, this character is superhuman. She can do anything. I sort of want to reassure the potential reader, there's a reason for that, which you will learn as the series develops. It is not happenstance. It is not the hand of God. It is not Deus Ex Machina. There's a reason why she is the way she is. But there's also a reason why she has some humility. And I think humility is rare in main characters. So I thought it might be interesting to have a taste of humility. And maybe I have some imposter syndrome myself. You know, writing is not my first career. And I'm always a little surprised when people like my books still.
You know, you made a career of it. Telling stories, histories in particular. And one of the things I love about this book is that even though it's set in the future, you pay a great deal of attention to history, and it's clear that the futuristic actions that characters undertake in their ships and the way the world is created is based on real history. So talk about writing. Having written so much past history where, you know, stuff is set in the past or in fantasy worlds where, you know, there's not our technology, how that kind of informs your creation of a future world and future technology?
Well, I would say that history is the base code of humanity's memory. And it was fashionable in some academic circles starting in the 90s to say that we were basically done with history, that we had created a civilization so very different from the past, and I could make a whole program out of this, that we really didn't need to concern ourselves much with the past, which is, to me, patently false and like almost comic when you just think of, say, American politics today and the word fascism, or I could name 100 things. Anyway, instead of going down that road, I'll say, so I love world building. And one of the things that I insist on in my own writing is that things happen for reasons and actions have consequences. And so I really wrote a past history almost before I wrote the book. Like I wrote a past history in detail of the 80 years before Marka and Baro walks up the brow to join her great ship. And then I sketched in the past history all the way back through what Marka and Baro's people call the Age of Chaos back to our present. And then as the novel went on and I learned things, because this is literally how I write, I'm writing and going, oh, that's interesting. I just said that. I guess that's how that plays out. Then I had to go back and sort of inform history about how that worked. So I was surprised to discover at some point that Earth's oceans died, or largely died. And that, where did that come from? I guess I read a lot of science. I read a lot of hard science. And so I think I was reading somebody's concerns about the oceans dying and thinking like, anyway, and that just appeared almost in conversation. But yeah, because nothing happens in isolation. And I think often speculative fiction can be preachy without accepting the million shades of gray that affect the real world. And they can't show the million shades of gray because they haven't provided enough detail to explain why one faction believes one thing and another faction believes another thing. And I mean, I'll use Star Wars, which I like just fine. Please don't imagine I'm criticizing Star Wars. But, you know, Star Wars has a sort of black and white good versus evil. And then much later in the Star Wars franchise, when we get to Andor, the sort of spy show on Disney, we discovered that there were some shades of gray and there were some fairly bad people acting for the rebellion. And there were some at least probably vaguely decent and honorable people who were imperial officers. And you go, see, it took that long to generate the backlog so that we could talk about the complexity of what it would be like to be a halfway decent person locked in a fascist government or whatever. Like the shades of gray take time. So in answer to your question, and I'm afraid I talk too much on almost any subject, in answer to your question, I generated a lot of history. And in answer to your sort of unasked question, I feel like without necessarily repeating it, that knowing what actually happened in the past and knowing what the factions were in Renaissance Venice and or in 1860s Japan, which totally fascinates me at the moment, the Meiji Restoration, understanding the complexity of factions that literally behave and think dichotomously. That is, they say one thing and do something very different. Helps you write a better world, a better universe where things are complicated. So one of the underlying threads, so Arcane Imperii, for listeners who don't speak Latin, means the secrets of empire. And one of the underlying threads to the whole series is that there's this trade system called the DHC, the Directorate of Human Corporations, that is gradually becoming, or perhaps already has become, an empire. And it didn't mean to be an empire. It meant to be a modestly profitable, almost socialist trade organization to support colony worlds. But time has passed. Everybody's expanded. There are more regulations, regulations about labor, regulations about shipping costs. And eventually, you send armed warships to enforce your regulations, and the next thing you discover, you're an empire. And that is all deliberate. But that took my understanding about what happened to the Dutch East India Company and what happened, you know, am I making sense here? Like, I'm basing this on human experience because that's all we know. That, to me, all we can talk about is our own history. So I read a lot of history. That, I guess, was my long-winded answer. The short answer is, yeah, I read a lot of history.
You know, one of the things, too, that I loved about this book was the way that you're able to present, because you have your essentially your Starfleet, your Star Wars, your Imperial, all these things set up as a trade organization, it really like sidesteps a lot of the unfortunate baggage of science fiction space operas. So talk a little bit about, you know, was this your idea, was to sidestep space opera but deliver all the goodies, the, you know, big starships and such?
What an excellent question. I wish I could give you a gold star. I really want to talk about this. So when you write an outline, when you try and sell a book, usually it has a shout line. It's the same in the movie industry, or that's my understanding. So you have something to try and catch an executive's eye at the top of the page. And my shout line was Venice in space. And apparently it worked because I got to sell the series. But obviously there's more to it than Venice in space. But in Venice, the merchant fleet could turn around and be the fleet. And that was true for hundreds and hundreds of years. And Venetian patricians, who were not the same as feudal lords because of complex internal politics, they didn't sit at home just making money. They went to sea. They were required to go to sea. So they participated in every aspect of the trade. And then in a time of war, they became the, you know, the Marines and the Navy officers, because it was all the same to them. And I would argue that you could almost say the same thing about the people we refer to as Vikings, and to a lot of ancient Greeks. Trade and war, not entirely separate. You go to foreign places, if they don't like you, they shoot at you. If they do like you, you trade. It's a fairly human interaction. So there's that aspect. But also, yes, I did want to, you know, it's popular in sci-fi, and I read a lot of sci-fi, to contrast Star Trek and Star Wars, and to sort of infer that one is more liberal and one is more conservative, and various other things can be said. But I would say, viewed from a distance, they're both, in a way, about military organizations. And okay, to be fair, it does rile me a little when people say Artifact Space is military sci-fi. And I'm like, nope, it's about trade with aliens and how that goes wrong. And there is definitely shooting. But I would argue that I believe a Renaissance Venetian would say, like, oh yeah, all one thing. This is how it goes. You know, sometimes you go to Alexandria and trade. Sometimes you go to Alexandria and they refuse you trade. You know, it's a complicated world. Well, I tried to make a complicated galaxy where you have to do this. And I also want to say, one of the things I very much enjoyed when I was in the Navy, the United States Navy, was we went all over, and the airplanes that my squadron flew had cargo. They had cargo pods and they could carry stuff, and we would land and take off and we'd deliver medical supplies and so on. And it was, in some ways, the most fun part of the military. Like, we were doing good things and we were doing humanitarian relief and stuff. So I thought from the beginning that I was going to work that into the book, that it was going to be about cargo and managing cargo. And one of the main characters in the book is a cargo officer, and that's like all she does. And I wanted to get across that there would be a whole career in just moving stuff around, and that every planet that had a human population would have the equivalent of a stock market to decide on the value of imported goods, and that this would complicate trade anyway. And I wanted all of these scenes to be real to people. As your ship comes in system, you're like, well, what are my commodities worth? Am I going to trade? Like, it would almost have to work that way. And I tried to make enough of the novel about that it wasn't a war novel.
You know, one of the things that I thought was so interesting about the book was the way that you do deliver. I have to say, the battle scenes are really well done, But I think the science fiction aspect is also really good. You use something, it reminds me, you talked about Al Reynolds. I'm a big fan of his. He was the second interview for this podcast some 25 years ago. So,
now I'm deeply honored because I love Alistair Reynolds. Yeah, okay.
So, I wanted to talk to you about using the time dilation and space travel that these people occur, and also the gravity and, you know, the physics of space travel. Is it usually in space travel that, you know, in both Star Wars and in Star Trek, you know, there's just no attention to gravity. Everything is just like, you know, you're walking around on a spaceship on Earth, which, as you point out, and as your readers experience in this book, is not the case. So talk about working all that out and also using that as a plot point, because it's a hell of a good plot point.
Yeah. So, I'm a storyteller, so I'm going to tell you a story. I think I was four pages into this book when I realized that I had basically scraped through calculus in high school, and now I was going to have to go back and learn calculus. And in addition to praising Alistair Reynolds, I want to praise a book called Infinite Series, which was a New York Times bestseller, which retaught me calculus. Fabulous book. Recommend it to anyone. I literally read 40 pages and thought, why did no one tell me this in high school? It actually explains the sort of why of calculus. And maybe I just appreciated it better at age 60. I don't know. But suddenly at age 60, I was doing calculus because, oh my goodness, the acceleration problems, the deceleration problems. And there's like a whole thread on Reddit about the math I got wrong. Fair. I did all the math myself. I did use a calculator, but it's my math. So if I got it wrong, I got it wrong. There's really nobody you can consult on like multiple body acceleration problems in space. I did learn, I'm getting to your question. I really am. But I learned fairly early on that for reasons of quantum physics that I am incapable of fully understanding, beam propagation would not be infinite. That is that like some sort of particle beam weapon would decay, and it would decay much more quickly than I thought, like over 10 or 12,000 kilometers instead of, I thought they'd go infinitely. I thought space was empty before I started writing this, and now I know better. All of which is by way of saying very early on, because I knew there was going to be battle scenes, I had to decide how I would create the kind of detail that would allow me to tell stories that included tactics and strategy. So here's a contrast, and I'm going to use Star Wars and Star Trek. I love both, but there's neither tactics nor strategy in either Star Wars or Star Trek. Once upon a time, we had Captain Kirk saying that Khan only thought in two dimensions in space, which sounded incredible to me, but at least it was a comment on how there's an up and down, there's, you know, like quite a number of options, and it made for some good cinematography. But we don't generally get a sort of interplay of how do the weapons work? How could we avoid some of their weapons while getting some of our weapons to work? But literally, this was my job in the Navy. And I was then and remain fascinated by what most people call electronic warfare, by how you hide, how you transmit, what counts as a transmission, what you can see, what you can't see, how you drink it in. And I wanted to work that in. And that, believe it or not, sort of immediately caused me to not be in the Star Trek universe. The technology of Star Trek is so high that I don't think any of us know how it works, so we don't need to worry about it. But I decided I wanted a lower level of technology. And I had already decided that, kind of like Jerry Purnell and Larry Niven in The Mode of God, in God's Eye, which is another one of my favorite novels, that I wanted humanity to be re-emerging from a time of relative technological darkness. Clearly, it wasn't complete darkness because the colonies throve, but they hadn't really got that far. They hadn't gotten a lot further than we are now. And that caused me to think deep thoughts about what does that mean about moving around? And then maybe they weren't that deep. It caused me to read other people's deep thoughts on the subject. And then I also knew that I was going to have multiple alien races that humanity did not know were out there. And that caused me to have to ask hard questions about how they worked. And if they were older, and they all are, why, how do they have technology? Is their technology so advanced it looks like magic to humanity, et cetera? Was that like anything like an answer?
Certainly beyond an answer, I thought it was wonderful. One of the other aspects I found really enjoyable about this book was the different character arcs and the way you introduced the different characters. This book necessarily has a large cast. Did some of the characters, were they created in the middle of the writing, or were they all there before and you are kind of moving them about?
You've done this before, I can tell. You ask great questions. Some of the characters were created before. I knew them from the beginning. So Thea Drake, Marka and Varro's best friend, although a little suspect at the beginning, is my daughter. And it was convenient because my daughter was, I think at the time, like 17. And I would just turn to her because these are 18-year-old women, like the characters. And I'd say, blah, 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 is the situation. What do you do? And my daughter has a great sense of humor and is great with the zappy line. And there's nothing more real than being fed a zappy line by a young woman who, can provide the, anyway. So that was a thing, but you're completely right. I'm feeling like you guessed this. Some characters created themselves as I wrote. I did not know Horatio Dorcas existed when I started writing. There's a lot you can read on Reddit or on Blue Sky or various places about writing, and people are divided into planners and pantsers. Planners, right? And I'm not sure I accept those categories because I do both. I had a very firm idea of where this novel went, how the arcs worked, but Quack Quack, the Inuit engineer, and Horatio Dorcas literally created at the speed of my typing. I don't know where they came from. They were there. I have never satisfactorily explained to myself why Horatio Dorcas, a patrician scientist, is on the ship with no military rank. No idea. I've created a backstory, but I was just writing along and there he was. And the same thing with the engineer. I might have told you early in writing that I was definitely going to have an senior engineer character who would be able to help with the communication with aliens. But a character who has ended up being an enduring character through the whole series, didn't know that was going to happen. Didn't know that was going to be my Canadian content. Didn't know that, and sometimes this is why my first love is ancient Greece, and the ancient Greeks actually believed that poets and writers had divine inspiration. Okay, I'm not going to try and sell you on divine inspiration, but when a character is fully realized as those, and to me they're fully realized, just comes into your head, it does feel like divine inspiration. Like, I didn't think through who they were going to be. I wrote it at the speed at which I type. While my brain's literally part of my brain's going like, well, this is a surprise. Who knew this guy was going to come on? And that is weird. And it, because I'm getting older, and getting older is real. I used to do this and I just kept writing. Now I stop and go to my scratch glossary and go like, Horatio Dorcas is this person who I have apparently created who does this, because otherwise I'll forget and he'll never occur in another scene. And then the characters grow on you. And this is the part of me that is not plotted. I didn't know when I started to write Richard Hanna that Marka Inbaro was going to decide he wasn't the one. He seemed like a nice guy to me as I wrote it. And then I literally believe that what happened because I was in a coffee shop listening to a woman tell another woman what was wrong with her boyfriend. And I'm like, yep, that just sounds like that doesn't work. Oh, that would make a good plot point in a novel. It's hard to describe where the inspiration comes from and what creates character and what leads to it. But yeah, sometimes it's planned. Sometimes it just happens.
You know, I love to eavesdrop. And so your story about eavesdropping in a cafe is something I've experienced many times, not with the writing outcome, but just to hear that story when you're not, it's dawn 10 for you, and to hear it and to realize the storiness of what you're hearing. And one of the things, again, that there are many parts of this novel that made it really super appealing to me. And one of them was that your emphasis on the import of luck and chance, because it plays such a huge part in our lives and nobody recognizes it, you know, unless they have, if you have bad luck, really bad luck. If you have good luck, well, I'm just who I am. I'm so great.
Yeah, I guess I have been relatively lucky in my life and I have seen the effect of fortune, which is sometimes horrific. And, you know, medieval Italians sort of worshipped Fortuna almost as an extra god. You can understand that. Like, I think there's a moment where something goes through Marco and Baro's windscreen and hits the back of her seat rest. And I wanted the reader to maybe think like that's how close we come to losing the series right there. I do a lot of various, mostly sword-based martial arts. And one of the things I know is that no matter how good you are, there's an element of luck. There's an element of that is beyond practice or training. And not a lot of old gunfighters or sword fighters in the world. I wanted there to be luck and I wanted to be recognizable to readers.
You had talked about the alien races, and that's absolutely one of the things I love about this book. You know, there are no four-headed aliens to be seen. They are weird, and we really can't even understand them, which I think is likely because, heck, we live on a planet. We've coexisted with whales and dogs and all sorts of creatures that are clearly quite intelligent and never been able to say much more than, come here, Pickles, come on, food time.
I wanted to be a marine biologist. It didn't work out that way, and I ended up as a medieval historian, which may seem like a long jump, and it is. But I did spend a lot of my youth wandering around on beaches looking at starfish, and that definitely affected one of the alien races. And I, believe it or not, wanted to make a sort of thematic point about irrationality, which really you won't see it until you read Deep Black, but that one of the alien races is physically appealing and kind of cute, and the other one is physically unappealing and kind of ugly, and that begins to affect all of human politics, even though it's utterly irrational. Was a deliberate decision. Like, I just, because rationality is overrated. I would love to imagine that I was rational, but anyway. That was deliberate. And I spent a lot of time on my aliens, and I read a bunch of other people's, I won't say pseudoscientific, I think it was mostly scientific, it was just speculative science about what we might encounter out there. And certainly what you say about whales, actually, that's why the third book is called Whale Song. I imagine someday we might understand something that whales say, but whales doing whale things for whale purposes may not even be within the experience that we even want to understand. You know, like dogs. My dog just ran by. Dogs might be thinking food, 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 pet, pet, food. And do you care? You know, like, and you're not going to have a treaty conversation with them. That's anyway. I wanted to make communication very, very difficult, but I also wanted to make the difficulties of communication part of the history, part of the background. I won't be revealing everything to say that one of my races has, in effect, multiple brains and also communicates simultaneously with both sound, gesture, and releases of chemicals like pheromones, and that that has evolved so that they could speak secretly in the presence of the race that had enslaved them millions of years ago. And that will gradually, that's not a giant spoiler. It will gradually come out over the course of the books, but it's there for a reason. It didn't evolve for no reason. And it's very complicated, and it's very hard for the human wannabe interpreters to break three codes at the same time.
Code breaking's a theme in this book, and I think it's interesting that you, as you point out, how important it is to our current civilization when we see it in the context of the novel.
Well, again, kind of like marine biology and a bunch of other things, I've always been fascinated by code breaking. I was amazed one day years ago to discover that the word secretary implies the keeper of secrets, because the original secretaries in Renaissance Italy were people who could put things into code and decode them when they were passed back and forth between, say, banks. And stuff like that fascinates me. But at the same time, yeah, you know, I read a bunch of stuff about linguistics. Linguistics is almost as impenetrable to me as quantum physics, but I read a bunch. And I took what I could from it to try and make the problems realistic. And at the same time, and I don't want to take up too much of your time with this, but one of the things that I learned way back in the day, and I brought this to the novel, I hope, is that there's a difference between breaking a code and traffic analysis. So you, if you break a code, you can read what the other person is saying. But with traffic analysis, you can say, well, suddenly they're talking a lot and they weren't talking a minute ago. You don't know what they're saying, but you're still learning something. And I tried to bring that part out too, the traffic analysis part, because when they're looking at what the various alien races are doing, they're trying to monitor. Well, we have no idea what they're saying, but how often are they saying it? Who are they saying it to? That can be looked at, and it might be revealing, and I tried to cover all that off.
There's a lot of technology in these books, and I'm wondering how much of this you worked out in advance. The size and shape of the rock of the spaceships is very important. Talk about creating technology that does not yet exist.
Well, where can I begin? I tried to base all of the technologies on things that do exist or on actual scientific articles that I could find either on the internet or in the University of Toronto Library. Even artifact space itself and relic particles actually came from a physics article. It was a speculative article. I don't think that's how the world works, but the idea was not mine. And the idea that the faster than light drive, which of course is extremely problematic for everything from time travel to whatever, but let us leave that aside, that it worked, but scientists still weren't exactly sure why it worked. That is actually based on some histories of 19th century science. Scientists did stuff in the 19th century and they weren't exactly sure why it was working. And in a way, that is chemistry until you have all kinds of modern, very modern concepts. I hope I won't disappoint anyone when I say that technology followed, not led, plot and character. That is, I was pretty sure what story I wanted to tell. And I knew the ships wanted to be large because Venetian and Genoese ocean-going galleys were large and aircraft carriers are large. And then when I sat down and decided, like, if you were trying to move, the great ships were originally designed to move populations off of Earth. I'm like, well, if you're trying to move large populations, ships got to be big. And then they're shaped like swords because I like swords there. But also because Alistair Reynolds taught me that ships moving at a substantial portion of the speed of light, like even 0.2C, actually have drag on monatomic hydrogen out there in the so-called void. And so they would have to be, to some extent, what we call aerodynamic. They would have to, because otherwise they might pick up too much monatomic hydrogen. And also because, you know, there's crap floating around in space, dust and stuff, and you don't want it slamming into your bow. So that was interesting. Like, let me just say, to be fair, I stand on the shoulder of dozens and dozens of giants. Like, I read science fiction. So some of my assumptions just come from other people's science fiction. I will, far from denying it, I'll brag about it. One of my favorite writers of all time is C.J. Sherry. C.J. Sherry's Down Below Station and Merchanter's Luck were to me the most inspiring thing I read, I think, in the early 80s, late 70s. Can't remember when I read them. I still read C.J. Sherry. I think her Foreigner series is, like, incredible. And I thought that she did a great job of imagining, well, interstellar trade, interstellar conflict, the pointlessness of interstellar conflict. That is, at one point, one of my characters is going to go, like, wow, you lose 80 ships and 12,000 people in a space battle. What proportion of your space empire's economic worth is that? And the truth is zero. It's like almost unnoticeable, which means that space war might be deadly, but it might go on forever because you can just produce more spaceships. Anyway, that's strategic thinking we needn't get into right now. But C.J. Sherry, Jerry Purnell, Alistair Reynolds, Ian Bank, there it is, finally. The culture. I was very inspired by Ian Banks. I have been for a long time, and I wanted to get across some of that. It's beyond modernity. Some of that political viewpoint on how the future almost has to be if everybody's going to live together and not be in an endless internal conflict and stasis. And some of it is modern politics. And I'm going back to an earlier question that you asked. So I'm amused by having my characters misrepresent history. And that's because we all do. Most people don't really remember history accurately. So at one point, one of the characters says, "We're socialists." And I have received more anti-fan mail about that. And it's like, well, that's how they understand socialism 7 centuries in the future, by which they mean that they have universal minimum income and they all have healthcare, which would be almost required in a spacefaring culture. Where do you put the poor people if you have to have closed environments? Anyway, I won't get into the whole thing, but some of it ends up being political simply because, I don't know, because I love ancient Greece, and ancient Greece involves philosophy, and philosophy involves understanding politics, and understanding politics creates history. It's all one thing. You can't really break it up. If you're going to have high technology, unless you're going to have serfs, you're going to end up having to share. But at the same time, a number of people said, but they're not really real socialists. They have patricians and near oligarchs. And I'm like, yeah, right. That's just what they think socialism is. Because we use words like capitalism, I'm pretty sure, while claiming that we're capitalists, that Adam Smith rolls in his grave every time a member of the Trump administration claims that we're capitalists and says, wait a minute, you're using government money to fund a company that's got government contracts, and you think that that's capital? Anyway, I don't mean to beat the drum, but it's funny, and we change things. And in another scene that you haven't read yet, because it's in Whale Song, but it doesn't give anything away. Two of the characters are playing a war game on a computer, and the African descended character wants to play the Confederacy because, as far as they know, that's the side that had most of the black people on it. And I meant that to be darkly humorous, because that is the kind of way we misremember history. I'm of Scottish extraction, and oh my goodness, the Scots, the Battle of Culloden, the Jacobite rebellions. Anyway, I won't get started.
You know, one of the things also that I loved at the book from the very beginning was the descriptions of the insides of the spaceships. And I have to say that back when I was impossibly young, I went on a tour of the Queen Elizabeth, which was at the time docked in Long Beach. And the way that looked, as I read your book, I just kept flashing back on the way that looked inside there. I thought, boy, this is an amazing idea that we would have spaceships that would look like luxury liners.
So, yeah. So I love craft. Some people love art. I love craft. I love things that are well made. I love things that are, when I say beautiful, I guess I mean where you can sort of see the effort that human beings put into the manufacture of that thing. Okay, that's part of it. But also, quite frankly, when I was about a third of the way through writing this, I thought, this would make a great Netflix series. What would distinguish it from all other science fiction in background? And I went, oh, also because trade ships often host traders. Traders are going to come aboard and they're going to look around. So instead of the sort of Spartan, high-tech, matte black plastic of some science fiction, I thought, why not have it all be aesthetic and represent a fairly old aesthetic? The ships themselves are 200 years old. Why not have it represent a former aesthetic and represent beauty? Because they want to impress. They want to impress customers. They want to impress their own sailors. And also because people are going to live for years in this environment. And this is one of the things that, as a veteran of aircraft carriers are, I won't call them ugly, but the spaces are absolutely utilitarian, virtually undecorated. And yet, once in a while, you see a flash of Victorian elegance here and there, polished brass, a bell. And maybe this isn't true of everyone. I came to quite enjoy the little touches of Victorian elegance aboard my aircraft carrier. And so I wanted to sort of transmit some of that. It's a different physical aesthetic from the way most people have imagined far future space opera.
The new book by Miles Cameron is Artifact Space. It's the first in a series. Thank you for joining me, Miles.
This was a great pleasure. Like I said, you asked some great questions.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.